And good evening. Today, on a day that saw heartbreaking congressional testimony from the brother of George Floyd, the president of the United States staked out a position on race in this country that falls short of what protesters are demanding, short of what lawmakers and branches of the military are now contemplating, short of where the National Football League went in a remarkable about-face last week, and where NASCAR went late today. Quoting from their statement, "The presence of the Confederate flag at NASCAR events runs contrary to our commitment to providing a welcoming and inclusive environment for all fans, our competitors, and our industry. The display of the Confederate flag will be prohibited from all NASCAR events and properties." The president, as you know, claims to be a big NASCAR fan. Today, he tweeted his opposition to renaming military bases named after men who fought under that very same flag. Quoting now, "The United States of America trained and deployed our heroes on these hallowed grounds and won two world wars. Therefore, my administration will not even consider the renaming of these magnificent and fabled military institutions." Now, just as an observation on the president's own point, the bases are indeed hallowed, as he says, but they're hallowed for the troops of all backgrounds they trained, not the men that they are named after who took up arms against this country. And the president may not know this, but those troops who fought and died in those two world wars, many of them were black, but they were not treated equally by the U.S. military at the time. The U.S. military was not desegregated until 1948, and that only happened at that time after a campaign of pressure by black Americans. Black Americans fought and died in both world wars for a country which at the time did not treat them as equal citizens under the law and made them train at bases named after Confederate generals. It is military commanders today who are now talking about replacing those Confederate names out of respect for the troops they now train. The president has also opposed taking down statues of Confederate war figures, and even as some Republicans in the House and Senate today spoke of working with Democrats to craft police reform legislation, members of the administration were out there denying a problem exists at all. Here's his top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, when asked if he thought systematic racism exists in this country.
I do not.
At all in the U.S.?
I do not.
You don't think there's any systemic racism against African Americans in the United States?
I will say it again. I do not. I think the harm comes when you have some very bad apples on the law enforcement side. What was done to Mr. Floyd was abysmal. Abysmal. But I believe everyone in this country agrees with that.
Well, keeping him honest, although the president has condemned George Floyd's killing, he's also retweeted attacks on Mr. Floyd's character and slandered people protesting his killing and had peaceful protesters assaulted outside the White House for a photo op at a church. As for outreach to the African-American community, he held a so-called listening session today at the White House with a group of African-Americans he described as his friends and supporters and members of his administration. And he listened as one by one, sort of dear leader style, they praised him for the job he's doing with regard to the black community.
I am delighted, Mr. President, that you have made it a priority to solve this problem.
Thank you, Mr. President, for allowing us to come.
I met President Trump when he was a businessman. I think he's a natural leader.
What we've done through your leadership is start to break down that system and fight back.
You've been nothing short of historical.
If you want to know the truth, if you want us to dissect the Obama economy, let's do it. And I think, Mr. President, your record will win the debate.
Believe me, there are many people that are on these online boards. They do support President Trump.
We appreciate everything you've done, Mr. President. You've been amazing.
I know you can do it. I know you can do it.
We'll do it. We'll do it, Wayne.
So that's one soundbite for the day, and so is this. George Floyd's brother, Philonese, before the House Judiciary Committee just a day after the funeral.
A man who took his life, who suffocated him for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, he still called him sir as he begged for his life. I can't tell you the kind of pain you feel when you watch something like that. When you watch your big brother, who you looked up to your whole entire life, die begging for his mom? I'm tired. I'm tired of pain. Pain you feel when you watch something like that. When you watch your big brother, who you looked up to for your whole life, die begging for his mom? I'm here to ask you to make it stop. Stop the pain. Stop us from being tired.
Joining us now is a member of the Judiciary Committee, Democratic Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas. Congresswoman Jackson Lee, thank you so much for being with us. Some Republicans agree with Democrats that I'll let you get the earpiece back in.
Thank you, Anderson. I was taking off my mask. Thank you
so
much.
No worries. I'm all for social distancing. I'm glad you're wearing a mask. I just took mine off.
Thank you.
Some Republicans agree with Democrats that policing in the United States needs to be reformed. Yet President Trump obviously is silent on this issue, focusing instead on what he calls law and order. It seems to me the protesters are also calling for law and order. They just want equal protection under the law. That's what true law and order is about. I'm wondering what you make of what the president has said and hasn't said so far.
Well, thank you, Anderson, for having me. You know, this is in the backdrop of the funeral and homegoing service, the monumental homegoing service in his hometown yesterday. And when I spoke to the family and talked about the goodness that has come out of wickedness, the weight of the world is on the Floyd family, and it certainly is on his younger brother who spoke his truth today and his pain. I don't know how anyone can listen to PJ, as we call him, Mr. Floyd, and his wife, who was there with him today as well, and Ben Crump, who's had a lot of cases like this, could even listen for just a moment. And even beyond listening, looking at the video that pierces one's soul, and say that we can't work together to do a reformational change that really moves policing in America away from the warrior attitude and the burden that African American men face, many unarmed, in confrontation and interaction with police officers, to the idea of guardian. That is what this legislation stands for, and it baffles me that the President of the United States and his staff can't take a deep dive into this legislation and realize that America just cannot continue on the pathway that it is, and that is that African American men, African American people, girls or women included, suffer the brunt in many instances of the misconduct of bad cops on the streets of this community and this nation.
You know, Larry Kudlow, the White House economic advisor today, said that he doesn't believe there is systematic racism in the United States. Now, he may actually believe that. I don't know if he does. But it just seems if there are large percentages of the population saying there is a real problem here, and just because you yourself, who may not be part of that group, has not experienced it for yourself, I would think it just seems like a respectful thing to do to not talk so much and maybe to listen more to those who are crying out and saying, you know what, this does exist, and to listen to their experiences and say, you know what, maybe just because I haven't experienced it myself, it doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
Truth is truth, and what the president needs to do, Anderson, is exactly what you have said. But he's got to broaden his sphere of those who he's willing to listen to, certainly beyond the table that was there today. It is clear, we had some excellent witnesses today. I can't call all of their names, but I do want to mention the president of the National Urban League, Mark Morial, former mayor. But also, he gave a historical record of lynching in America during the history of slavery, 4,000 African-Americans, black slaves, were lynched, and then continuing on into Jim Crowism. That is a stain of racism that has never been eliminated. And unfortunately, there are 18,000 police departments in the United States. This legislation talks about accreditation. In accreditation, you have to pierce into this bias and this discrimination. And law enforcement officers, the head of the major chiefs from Houston, Chief Acevedo, acknowledged that black people, people of color, have experienced this discrimination, and everyone now understands Black Lives Matter, and it does not insult anyone else. Black lives do matter, and the president has to, in order to be an effective leader and healer, and to be able to look at legislation that can be both the front end and the back end, yes, he's got to expand the voices he listens to. I would point him to the peaceful protesters, the young black, Hispanic, Latinx, Asian Americans, and African Americans who are in the streets peacefully. Why doesn't he listen to those voices? Because he will find many stories that may not have resulted, obviously, in death, but he will find the pain there. And I just want to say one thing, that I'm a mother, and I said that yesterday. Even as I'm talking to you, Anderson, I have a sense of pain, because I can see the video right now of George Floyd. Imagine his family laying on that ground and crying out, "I can't breathe." But I can also hear law-abiding citizens who just were reaching out to the police, asking and begging them to stop. They didn't charge the police. They were begging him to stop. And a 17-year-old girl is the one that got this video that is going to be with us for the rest of our lives.
Congressman Sheila Jackson Lee, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
I want to get perspective now from CNN's chief political analyst, Gloria Borger. Gloria, I mean, it should seem clear to anyone with eyes and a conscience at this point that the president sees no need and certainly no real political benefit or any political benefit to address in any serious way racial and systematic inequalities that exist in this country.
I think there's no interest in doing it on his part, and I also think there's no ability to do it on his part. Just think about what happened today, Anderson. You have NASCAR banning Confederate flags. If the president had an interest in racial healing, he might tweet, "This is a great idea. Thank you, NASCAR." He knows a lot of his voters are NASCAR fans. He says he's a big NASCAR fan. Why not applaud them? That's really easy for doing the right thing. Why not applaud your Secretary of Defense and your Secretary of the Army for saying they would at least entertain a discussion of changing the names of those military bases? But instead, what'd he do? He shut it down. So this is a president who can't really acknowledge the legitimate protesters, and most all of them are, I have to say, and the protesters out there calling for racial justice. He can't talk about them, because what he wants to talk about, Anderson, is law and order. And that gets in the way of the message which says to the protesters, "I hear you, I understand you, I want to help fix this in that country." He just cannot give that speech.
Well, also, I mean, the names of these bases, they were named at a time when black people were not serving equally,
right,
or allowed to serve equally, even though black people were, you know, volunteering to fight for this country, the very country which was treating them as second-class citizens or third-class citizens.
That's right. And this is a president, you know, who talks about heritage a lot. You know, he tweeted, you know, "These names of these bases are a great part of our heritage." And I remember that after Charlottesville, and I looked it up today, that he actually used the same word and tweeted it and said that, you know, complained about the media and said that we were trying to hurt American heritage. And so in his own mind, that is what it is. And by the way, he's talking to military people and about military bases. And he is somebody who did not serve, who claimed to have bone spurs, which, as we know, Michael Cohen said he never had. And yet he is saying to his Secretary of Defense, "I don't want you to have that discussion with people who currently serve in the military."
Well, also, if people are speaking out against racism and the response is you're criticizing America, that's the response of somebody who is linking racism with America. So, I mean, he's sort of arguing their point for them by making that linkage in the way he responds. Gloria, I appreciate you being with us. Thank you, Gloria Borger. Coming up next, what the White House press secretary had to say when confronted with the fact that her boss spread a baseless conspiracy theory about a man who will be in the hospital for weeks from what police did to him, and what it says about her boss's approach and her approach, frankly, to the truth. We're keeping him honest. And later, breaking news, a grim new prognosis on how many more Americans may soon die from the coronavirus as cases spike in states nationwide. The number, another 100,000 people in this country may die, according to authorities. It's stunning, and it comes from one of the leading experts in the field. Well, of all the cowardly weasel phrases out there, this one seems to be the go-to lately. I was just asking. You hear it whenever a public figure says something stupid, ill-advised, ill-informed, or just plain ugly. And it gets used, it seems, whenever a better or more accurate phrase might be, "I said the wrong thing," or "I was mistaken," or the rarely heard phrase from politicians, "I'm sorry." Those are phrases we try to say to people we respect and care about in our lives. It's what we expect of others, especially those that we look up to. Well, today, the spokeswoman for the president of the United States demonstrated that the president cannot do just that. She signaled his lack of caring, his lack of respect for the people he was elected to lead and for the truth. Now, yesterday, the president said something hurtful and factually unfounded and just plain wrong about an elderly man pushed and injured by police and hospitalized. What's more, he said it at the worst moment imaginable, just as good people on all sides of the political spectrum all over the country are grappling with so much and trying to do the right thing about it. The president promoted a conspiracy theory about the moment that we've probably all seen by now, but bears showing again, if only to underscore that outside the rantings of a few fringe groups and individuals, there's not a lot of dispute about what you see in this video. I'm not hearing sound. The video, of course, is of Buffalo police shoving Martin Gugino to the pavement during a Black Lives Matter protest. A week later, he is still hospitalized right now with brain trauma and could be for another 2 weeks. Now, he's 75 years old. He's a longtime left-leaning Catholic social activist. Two police officers have been charged with felony assault, and what they did generated widespread condemnation across the political spectrum. Those are facts. Now, here's the conspiracy theory, which the president tweeted out to nearly 81 million followers. Quote, Buffalo protesters shoved by police could be an Antifa provocateur. 75-year-old Martin Gugino was pushed away after appearing to scan police communications in order to black out the equipment at OANN. I watched he fell harder than was pushed, was aiming scanner, could be a setup. As we mentioned last night now, this whole notion the president is tweeting about came from a Russian-born alleged reporter on a fledgling right-wing network who also has written for the Kremlin propaganda outlet Sputnik. I mean, you can't make this up. It sounds like he's making this up, but he worked for Sputnik. His source for this nonsensical theory was an item on a conspiracy theory website by a poster who goes only by the name of Sundance. Good source. White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany was asked about it right out of the gate at today's press conference. Listen.
Kayleigh, thank you so much. Does the president regret tweeting out a baseless conspiracy theory about a 75-year-old protester on the morning of George Floyd's funeral?
The president was asking questions about an interaction in a video clip he saw, and the president has the right to ask those questions.
But does he regret tweeting out this protester was assaulted?
The president does not regret standing up for law enforcement men and women across this country. And let me say this and just give you a little bit about the mindset behind the president's tweet. Look, we're living in a moment that is, it seems to be reflexively anti-police officer. And it's unacceptable to the president. In this tweet that he sent out, he was in no way condoning violence. He was not passing judgment on these two officers in particular. But what he was saying is this. When we see a brief snippet of a video, it's incumbent upon reporters and those who are surveying the situation to ask questions. Rather,
upon the president to have facts before he tweets anything out. He's the president of the United States.
The president did have facts before he tweeted out that undergirded his questions.
Baseless conspiracy theory.
It's not a baseless conspiracy.
Actually, it is. Webster's dictionary defines it as a theory that explains an event or set of circumstances as a result of a secret plot by usually powerful conspirators. Well, the president said Mr. Gugino was a member of the group Antifa, which the president has, without evidence, portrayed as the driving force behind all these protests. It's not. Nor is there any evidence that the 75-year-old man is a member of that group. He said he was a provocateur, and there's no evidence he was. He suggested he was using some super secret device in his phone to locate police by their radios. First of all, his friend last night told us this man, who's 75, could barely turn on his own phone. And second, why would somebody need a tracking device to locate police who are all around him? It's pretty clear where they are. The president also accused Mr. Gugino of faking his fall.
One of the things that the president said in his tweet was that the gentleman fell harder than he was pushed. How does that work in terms of physics?
Look, the president raised several questions based on a report he saw. He has a right to ask those questions. And where he stands is squarely with law enforcement. He was making no judgments, not condoning violence, not saying what happened in this case with these two officers was right or wrong. But he's standing back and saying, we need to ask questions before we destroy lives and convict people in the court of public opinion.
Okay. I mean, that is such doublespeak. It's Orwellian. He was just asking questions. But before we defame somebody and convict them in the court of public opinion, we need to find out facts. He sent out a tweet defaming this man, convicting him in the court of public opinion to 81 million of his followers. This is a 75-year-old guy who has been protesting for a lot of his life. It's a whole range of issues. And that, what Kayleigh McEnany said there, I mean, there you have it. The president, she says, wasn't pushing a conspiracy theory, wasn't speaking without the facts, wasn't slandering a man who was literally bleeding from the ears after falling. But last night said he does not even bear any ill will toward the officers who pushed him. That's what Mr. Gugino said. Doesn't bear ill will toward the officers who pushed him, for which he is now in the hospital. Got out of the ICU, thankfully, but he's still in the hospital. You know, the president, he was only asking questions, just asking, calling on us to do the same. All right, here's a question. What kind of person is so impulse-driven, so lacking in empathy that he attacks an elderly man in a hospital bed who is simply protesting peacefully? What kind of person does that? I'm just asking. Here's another one. What kind of person is too vain and cowardly to ever admit a mistake? Just asking. What kind of person hires someone who promises never to lie to us, as Kayleigh McEnany did on her first day on the job, and then breaks that promise repeatedly? Just asking. And what kind of person is so in need of making a name for themselves in the public arena that they betray the convictions they once expressed openly on television when they called Donald Trump's statement on Mexican immigrants racist, but now lie about why they said that in order to keep their job as the president's chief apologist and lie teller? I'm just asking. Up next, a new sobering projection on the number of U.S. deaths from coronavirus. The breaking news ahead on 360. There's breaking news on the coronavirus. The director of the Harvard Global Health Institute projects another 100,000 deaths from COVID-19 by September. That would mean between 800 to 1,000 Americans are going to die every single day until September. Right now, the U.S. death toll stands at nearly 113,000, with nearly 2 million cases reported. And that news from Harvard is just one of several important pieces of the picture today. We have more on all of it now from our Erica Hill.
Sobering new data about coronavirus-related hospitalizations. Up in at least a dozen states since Memorial Day weekend.
It was our highest day yet of hospitalizations. I continue to be concerned.
In Arizona, 79% of the state's ICU beds are currently in use. The director of health services asking hospitals to activate their emergency plans and reduce or suspend elective surgeries. The overall trends alarming health officials.
What concerns me is, do we have the systems in place to ensure that a case in a community doesn't lead to a cluster, doesn't lead to an outbreak, doesn't lead to a healthcare system once again getting overwhelmed?
Across the country, 19 states reporting a rise in new cases over the past week, including Florida, Georgia, and South Carolina, among the first to reopen. Much of the Northeast seeing a decline.
It has to be done right, and we have to stay disciplined. And the evidence is all around us. What happens if we're not?
New CNN polling shows Americans are split when it comes to returning to their regular routines and whether the worst is behind us. Women are more likely than men to exercise caution. Just 38% say they're ready to resume those routines. And yet, the country moves forward.
I've missed it. I mean, this is the reason I live here.
Miami's beaches reopened this morning. Students in Vermont and Rhode Island will be back in the classroom this fall. NASCAR fans can watch the action in person with masks and distanced this weekend in Homestead, Florida. The U.S. government says it will fund and study three experimental vaccines this summer, including one from Johnson & Johnson, set to begin human trials next month.
And Erica Hill joins us now. Los Angeles County is continuing to loosen restrictions. What does that look like so far?
Yeah, in fact, they announced a lot of restrictions will be loosened as of Friday, Anderson. We're talking about gyms and fitness facilities, campgrounds, RV parks, hotels and lodging, daycare, and they also did camps, rather. And the other thing that will really, I think, get a lot of people talking, music, film and TV production can also resume on Friday. Now, they said they're going to put out further guidelines tomorrow about distancing requirements. Obviously, they want people to continue to use face coverings and to practice social distancing, but they'll offer more specific industry guidelines coming tomorrow. But that is a big move forward for Los Angeles County.
Erica Hill. Erica, thanks so much. Appreciate it. Joining me now is Dr. Lena Nguyen, emergency room physician and former Baltimore Health Commissioner. Dr. Nguyen, I mean, the idea that there can be another 100,000 deaths in this country by September, according to this Harvard projection, I mean, it's a staggering number as states are continuing to reopen. I mean, I don't know if it's a wake-up call or what it is, because it seems like there is now this kind of collective decision just to move along. I mean, just to get on with reopening.
This is the problem, Anderson, because these numbers are actually not surprising. That's the number. 200,000 is what we get at the current rate of deaths that we're at now. I mean, obviously, this is devastating, though, because unlike before, unlike months ago when maybe we didn't know how to prevent infections, we actually know exactly what it takes. We know that we need this national strategy. We know we need testing, which we keep talking about, but is not nearly at the level that we need in order to reopen safely or to continue reopening. We know that we need clear, direct messaging that's led by public health experts following the science. And I think that there has just been this complacency that set in. And that's the devastating part, that we know how to prevent the next 100,000 deaths, but we're not doing that.
I mean, do you feel there are mixed signals on just where we're at in this response? Because the White House, you know, the White House task force seems to basically have, you know, disappeared. They aren't meeting internally every day any longer. They're not speaking publicly as a group. It seems like clearly the White House wants to distance itself as much as possible from talk of the coronavirus.
I agree with you that that's what seems to be happening, but this virus is not going away. And I think this is the important message for everyone to hear. For hospital leaders, they should be preparing for the next surge now so that we don't run into the problem of not having enough masks and personal protective equipment. I mean, it was a national disgrace that we ran out last time. What's going to be our excuse this time? And policymakers should be doing everything to increase that testing, tracing, isolation, again, the public health infrastructure that we know we need. And I think the message for the American people is don't take unnecessary risks, that we know that there's going to be more transmission of the virus just as people are up and about. And in fact, this is a time that we should be on our guard even more than before. We should be doubling down and doing even more social distancing as much as we can, wearing masks, washing our hands, because we have to take actions into our own hands if we're not going to see the federal government leading the way.
Dr. Lena Wan, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. Just ahead, a comedian from the writing staff of Late Night with Seth Meyers joins us. Amber Ruffin is her name. She's been using her platform on the show to share with the nation the painful, often dangerous encounters she's had with police as a black woman. We'll be right back. For African Americans, stories about police abuse are all too common. However, as our next guest has recently said, they don't often share these stories because, in her words, there's this unspoken rule that black people are supposed to take it in stride. Amber Ruffin is a comedian, writer on the Late Night with us, on Late Night with Seth Meyers. Last week, she would open the show with stories of her own encounters with police. For instance, this one about the time she had arrived in Chicago from Amsterdam, was in the car with a friend, Jeff, who was white. They parked. She exited the car to grab another friend for dinner, just skipping down an alleyway. Here's what she said.
Little did I know, skipping down a police station alley is a big no-no because I end up skipping towards a cop car that's driving at me down the alley. The sirens go off. A cop gets out and his gun is drawn and he goes, "Put your hands on the hood of the car. Put your hands on the hood." This man is furious. I comply and his partner pats me down. Now this man is livid. It makes no sense. His anger level towards me is insane. I'm a young, adorable delight, literally skipping down the street, and I've infuriated him. So the cop and I see Jeff, and thank God Jeff didn't come running up to us because he could have gotten us both shot. But the cop sees that Jeff, a white man, has seen all of this, and he changes his attitude with the quickness. He's suddenly professional instead of antagonistic. That man could have shot me in a second. People who know me would be running around talking about attacking an officer. It doesn't seem like something Amber would do, but the officer said she did. So that has to be what happened.
And joining me now is Amber Ruffin. Amber, thanks so much for being with us. One of the things you mentioned in your stories is that every black person has stories like this, that your stories aren't the exception in any way. And I completely believe that to be true. I also believe that to be devastating in many ways, not the least of which it just shows how ingrained perceptions or attitudes of race are in humans and in law enforcement. And does one change that? I mean, do you believe it can be changed?
Great question, Anderson Cooper. I mean, I don't know if it can be changed. I like to think that it can, But I like to think that this is the beginning of that happening. But it will take a lot of work. Luckily, it seems like a lot of people are committed to doing the work. So friggin' fingers crossed.
I mean, you're a comedian, you're an incredibly talented writer. So the way you tell the story, on the one hand, there's part of me that's smiling at the notion of, you know, adorable you skipping down this alley, and you're telling a well-told story. And then on the other hand, it's just devastating and deeply sad. And this notion that you're just supposed to take it in stride and other people are just supposed to take it in stride, that's just not right.
Yes, that is true. I feel like it's part taken in stride, yes, but also like once you say to your white friend, oh my gosh, you'll never believe what happened to me, then you run the risk of them saying, oh, grow up. You know, anyone could respond in any way to you. So it's just has felt safe to not be running around talking about it. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
no,
that's kind of sad, but true.
Well, also, I mean, in so many of the stories, the reaction of, you know, of a white person you happen to be with is also just so telling. And, you know, they are horrified often and angry and trying to defend you. I want to just play another story, part of another story that you share, because this one, yet again, I was just, let's just play this.
My friend rolls down the window and the cop is super nice. Now, I had never been stopped by a cop while a white man was around. And the respect this cop had for this white man in the suit, he goes, I stopped you because there's been a lot of prostitution. And I go, oh, I'm not a prostitute. This cop has never believed anything less. He looks at our IDs and he asks us more questions. And my white friend is getting annoyed at this cop. And the cop can tell. But I'm like, oh my gosh, please just calm down and be cool. My friend says to the cop, he goes, you have nothing. You have to let us go. And I'm like, you just got me killed. But the cop goes, okay, but you have to leave. Okay, and that was it.
I mean, you're on your way to a party. You're feeling great about yourself. You're in, I think you said it was like a velvet dress or something, your favorite party dress. And the reaction is that you're a prostitute. I mean, and to me, what made it even worse is you were upset that your friend is, you know, speaking back to the police officer saying you have to let us go. And I mean, it's just so messed up.
Isn't that crazy? Because he was right. I was running them wrong. And it's so obvious, you know, once you're telling these stories out loud, how conditioned you are to just take it. It's crazy. And, you know, hopefully that's breaking. And hopefully people can start to see, you know, their worth and their rights. But Anderson, that outfit was gorgeous.
I have no doubt about that. I mean, look, I got to tell you, your outfits in all of these bits that you're doing have been quite, you know, right on point. I mean, you've, you know,
Anderson, you
put some thought into it.
I do. Thank you for noticing.
I mean, I can wear the same thing every night. No one notices because who cares what, you know, this old man is wearing. But I've also heard you say that now is the time for everyone to be angry and to be uncomfortable. Can you just talk about that a little bit? Because I've been talking today to a number of protest leaders, and they all talk about that idea of, you know what, now is the time for you to be uncomfortable, because there's a lot of folks who have had to be uncomfortable every single day for an awfully long time.
Yes, there has been. I mean, okay, so like I was saying a minute ago, when you tell a story like that to someone, they could get mad, or the most common reaction is they feel very uncomfortable, and you can tell, and you kind of hurry through the story. You don't want to blah, blah, blah. But I think it's time for them to sit with that discomfort, you know, to hear it and let it really affect them, because It's scary to look at that and know that you're subject to that happening over and over again. And a lot of white people can't even get near that thought. Mm. It's too painful. Meanwhile, we're running around living smack dab in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's get uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, the reaction of your, you know, your friends who are white, who are with you in these various stories, the reaction of the police officer when he sees your white friend and how, as you said, just it changed in a split second.
In a split second. Yeah. It's nuts. I was at any time you tell a story like this to a black person, they go, yeah, man, what are you going to do? Yeah. And that's kind of like the extent of it. But white people, they're hearts are broken. They cannot fathom such a thing. Yeah. And they're right. I'm going to try to get like that.
Yeah. Well, Amber Ruffin, I'm so glad you were on tonight, because I've just been watching what you've been doing, and I just think it's really powerful and important. So thank you.
I love you too, Anderson.
I was saying it with my eyes. You know, I like to keep all my feelings deep down inside, because it's what wasps do. Amber, thank you. Actually, stick around in the commercial break if you will. I just want to say something to you off camera for a second. We'll be right there. Still ahead, with all the calls to reform police, we'll show you how one city dissolved its department years ago and built a new one. Let's check in with Chris, see what he's working on for Cuomo Primetime at the top of the hour. Chris?
We're looking at progress. Where do we find it? Specifically in the case of George Floyd, one of the officers made bail today. Very provocative statements from the chief of police about what the duty of the officers were who were watching the one with the knee on George Floyd's throat. Interesting. We heard the pain today of his family in front of Congress. Will that pain lead to purpose? We'll talk to somebody else who was there about why things haven't really changed. Then we're going to look at the COVID cases. Why are they popping up? Why do we have one of the experts believing that the number of dead may double before the fall? We'll take on all those.
Yeah, Chris, alarming numbers that 100,000 more people may die in this country.
Well, I want to ask him why. Yeah. Why? Yeah. Because, you know, that's not a guarantee. I want to get into the mind, because we're getting hit with way too many different suggestions about what could happen, what can't, what to do, what not. So let's get inside the why.
Yeah. All right, Chris, see you in just a couple of minutes. Coming up, you're going to hear a lot about police reform in the coming days. Tonight, we'll look at how one city reformed its police department by disbanding it. We'll tell you exactly what that meant, the details when we return. One of the big questions about reforming police departments is how far can you go? If you've already tried reforms and if they don't work, can you simply do away with a police force? That seems unlikely. But that is essentially what Camden, New Jersey did more than 7 years ago. Of course, they still have a police force, but we'll explain how. Once a byword for violent crime, Camden scrapped its police force and started from scratch, essentially. They saw a dramatic drop in crime as a result. Our Gary Tuchman reported on this novel approach shortly after it began. He's back with a look at whether it's one other cities might be able to replicate.
Did you disband the Camden Police Department?
Yeah, and so at the end of 2012, into early 2013, every member of the Camden City Police Department was fired, including myself, and a new police force called the Camden County Police Force was created, and it was staffed.
Scott Thompson is the recently retired police chief. His disbanded city police force meant no more police union and the ability to make new work directives. The union is now back, but the work directives and new traditions remain innovative. Like this. Serving barbecue or ice cream is a regular feature of the community-oriented policing that is done here in Camden.
Jeremiah, can I get a high five, man?
Where the nearly 400 cops in this city of roughly 77,000 are expected to walk the streets and personally get to know those they are policing.
That's our future recruit right there.
Crime is still a problem here, but violent crime is way down since a high point in 2012 when the city police department was disbanded. Homicides down by about 63% as of last year. And the department says excessive force complaints against police are down 95%, all amid this directive.
You will use force as an absolute last resort, and you will de-escalate. There must be an attempt to de-escalate a situation prior to using force.
This video from a few years back shows an example of that policy. A man flailing a knife inside a store. He continues doing so outside.
Drop the knife!
It's a dangerous situation.
Drop the knife!
But police stay calm and let it play out on the downtown streets. It looks like a bizarre parade.
They enveloped the individual, and they walked 5 city blocks without using deadly force.
The suspect was safely apprehended.
There's another very notable principle to abide by if you're a Camden County police officer, and that is you're mandated to notify a supervisor if a fellow cop violates any of these directives.
We have to intervene. If that officer's doing something wrong at that moment, it is your job, because if not, you're as wrong as that officer that's doing
it. So if one of these two guys, and I know you guys wouldn't do this, but hurt someone, and they were being peaceful, you would report them?
I would probably take the badge right off of his chest at that moment, because it says service before self, and he's not carrying truth to that oath that he took.
And you'd do the same thing to him?
Yes, sir. Absolutely, sir. I expect nothing less.
This reimagined police force gets a lot of attention here.
You've heard what's going on in the country right now with cops.
Yeah.
Do you think your cops here in Camden are different?
Yes, they're very different. They treat us nice, polite, and they're very cool with us.
There is criticism, though, that the Camden County Police Force doesn't have enough minority officers, isn't transparent enough, and may not be responsible for the crime drop. Kevin Barfield is the president of the local NAACP.
The crime statistics have been going down throughout the state of New Jersey and has been going down within the nation. So I would not credit that with the policing programs that have or are supposed to be taking place right now.
The former police chief says the department can improve while keeping its principles.
I think that most of the police officers here get it. Every once in a while, we get one that doesn't. And we move swiftly and with certainty to remove them from the force.
Anderson, since the death of George Floyd, there have been 2 protests here in Camden, both of them peaceful. A week and a half ago, the first protest, at least 10 police officers participated, and one of the participants from the police force was the current chief of the Camden Police. He was holding a banner in support of the cause. And I should mention to you, Anderson, that the police provided to the demonstrators ice cream from Mr. Softy. Anderson.
Fascinating. Camden, New Jersey. Gary, thanks very much. The news continues. I want to hand it over to Chris for Cuomo Primetime.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.